Good afternoon. Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Eco News Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, Eco News. And joining me by phone is Andrea Rogers, staff attorney with Our Children's Trust. Andrea is a personal hero of mine and is bringing groundbreaking litigation to force state and federal government to take climate change seriously. So welcome, Andrea. I am so pleased that you could join us here today on the Eco News Report.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's get to know you a little bit better. I'd like to know kind of about your pedigree, where you come from, where you went to school, and how you got into this line of work.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm based in Seattle, Washington, and I'm originally from Seattle. I grew up here on the shores of our beautiful Puget Sound, and I was actually born in Washington, D.C. I'm in the family business, I guess you could say. My dad has been teaching environmental law for over 50 years, and his name's Professor Bill Rogers. I think you could say he's one of the founders of the field in this country. And he was teaching at Georgetown when I was born, and then Seattle was our summer home, and then we moved out back to Seattle so he could continue to teach at University of Washington when I was about 5 years old. So I grew up here, and environmental law was a big part of my life growing up. I always tell people, and you can see it in our family photos, our family vacations weren't to typical places. We often went to Superfund hazardous waste sites and fish hatcheries and mines and other kind of environmental disasters as part of his work. So I've always been around that and have my own love of the natural world as well. Growing up on the shores of Puget Sound is a very special place for those of you, your listeners, who have seen it. It's quite remarkable.
It is. And so I'm also from Seattle, and I'm a Roosevelt High School grad. Are you Ballard?
I'm actually Lakeside. I went to the school where Bill Gates went to school. I started out a little school called Evergreen School. It's a small school up in North Seattle. And then I went to Lakeside, both the middle school and the upper school.
Well, I would have made fun of you in high school then for going to Lakeside.
I know.
And I should also mention that your dad is another personal hero of mine, and he was my mentor at the University of Washington. And so I'm so appreciative of your entire family. But let's get back to you. What do you do for Our Children's Trust?
Well, what we're doing is, like you, I have several mentors in my life who have, you know, really had a big influence on the kind of legal practice that I do. And one of those is a woman named Professor Mary Wood, who's a law teacher at the University of Oregon School of Law. And her expertise is in environmental law and Indian law, and with a special focus on an ancient legal doctrine called the public trust doctrine. And she, over the last several years, she has developed a theory called atmospheric trust litigation. And the notion is that sovereign governments hold essential natural resources in trust on behalf of the citizens of each sovereign government. And the atmosphere should be included as part of those resources, because I don't think there's any resource we share more than the air. So her theory is that because our statutory environmental laws, as strong and as good as they may be in this country, unfortunately have not been effectively implemented and enforced to address the climate crisis that we're facing. So she developed a legal theory that we would use because they are the ones who are going to be experiencing the most significant climate impacts, that they are able to bring a legal cause of action against their sovereign governments to force their sovereign governments to take action on climate change. So we are essentially putting that legal theory into practice. And we are bringing cases in all of the 50 states against the federal government. And also we are working on developing cases in different countries as well. And the common thread that runs through all of this is that the cases are all brought on behalf of youth, the youth-driven organization, as well as an initiative. and we're invoking the public trust doctrine and the Constitution to protect their rights.
It's really, really cool stuff, and it's really groundbreaking. Let's start talking about kind of the public trust doctrine, because it is fascinating. And I think that listeners may be somewhat familiar with trust under the law. You have a beneficiary, and then you have somebody who holds the trust estate for the benefit of the beneficiary. And the public trust doctrine is somewhat similar to kind of our ordinary trust law. Can you talk a little bit about its historical roots? Because as you said, it is an ancient doctrine. How far back does it date? And if it's so far back, how do we have it in our law today?
Yeah, well, oftentimes people call it natural law, which means, you know, it's something it's part of who we are. And I don't know if you have heard of the concept of the tragedy of the commons. That was developed by Garrett Hardin, who was a professor at my alma mater, the University of California at Santa Barbara. And the notion is, if there are a limited number of resources, and if you don't regulate the way that people use those limited resources, you're going to run out of those resources. And it's just sort of common sense, you know? And I think all different forms of human societies recognize that when there are shared resources, that there's a need to have some sort of rules about how they're used and accessed. And, you know, the Native American tribes in this area who have been fishing for salmon for time immemorial, they had very similar rules and customs in terms of how to manage the resource so that it wouldn't go away. And that's what the public trust doctrine is. It was first written down under Roman law, essentially, and in the Code of Justinian, it says, by the law of nature, these things are common to all mankind, the air, running water, the sea, and consequently the shores of the sea. So there was a notion at that time that there's certain things that we all share, and as humans, we depend upon, such as air and water. And it became part of English common law, and under English common law, it's commonly thought of as that the crown holds the natural resources. They own the wildlife and the land, but they don't own it in a way that's traditionally held property right. They own it in trust on behalf of the citizens. So there's a responsibility that comes along with that ownership. As you mentioned, in a traditional trust, the fiduciary has certain obligations. They can't squander the resource. They can't lie to the beneficiary about what's going on with the resource. There's certain rules, and those same rules can be applied, but simply in the natural resource context. And how that notion of natural law is something that came, and many nations and states have it as a part of their jurisprudence. And the leading public trust case in the United States is called Illinois Central Railroad versus Illinois. And in that case, the city of Chicago gave its entire harbor and the land underlying the harbor to a railroad company. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. Even though these are state lands, you cannot give them away to a private corporation. There are public rights there. And what the court said about that is they said the state can no more abdicate its trust over property in which the whole people are interested than it can abdicate its police powers in the administration of government. So essentially what that means is that this is an attribute of sovereignty. The public trust responsibilities are an attribute of sovereignty and don't go away unless the sovereign government goes away. Now, it's codified in the law in a variety of different contexts. Some states have the public trust doctrine enshrined in the state constitution. Probably the best example of that comes from the state of Hawaii. Other states have it. It's recognized in their statutory law that it exists, but it may not be explicitly referenced in the constitution. Washington state is a little bit of halfway in between. The case law says that it's partially codified in the Constitution, but it's also just a notion that reflects reserved rights that the citizens maintained when the government was created. So it's in a variety of different contexts. There's a number of different judicial decisions interpreting and applying the public trust doctrine. But we are the first to ask courts of law to apply it to the atmosphere. We don't think that's very novel because, as I mentioned with the Code of Justinian, it was talked about the air being a common natural resource protected by the public trust doctrine. So I think instead of us trying to plow new ground, I think we're really trying to go back to the original intent of what the doctrine was intended to protect and encompass.
So you've brought cases in Washington State and federal court. In both of these jurisdictions, what has been recognized as a public trust resource, and why is the climate not a kind of a broad or kind of out there thing to recognize as part of the public trust?
Yeah, well, all of the cases, and most of the public trust cases, really dealt with navigable waters and shorelands and tidelands. And that makes common sense, because what was the first thing that we as a society have been fighting about in terms of a limited resource? Water. That's the thing that, you know, over the last couple of hundred years that everybody has wanted to privatize and has needed access to and means to use. So water is really where the case law developed. So many practitioners believe that the public trust doctrine only applies to water. But again, as I mentioned, if you look at it historically, that's just not the case. And it really was intended to encompass all common natural resources. So in our cases, we're asking the court to find that the atmosphere is a public trust doctrine. Now, interestingly, in both the Washington case and in the federal case, the court said, you know, we don't even need to make that finding that the public trust doctrine applies to the atmosphere, because there's no question that the atmosphere is connected to navigable waters and the waters. They understood the science that says, you know, the atmosphere is really, you can't separate that from the waters that are on Earth. So the court really didn't feel like they had to go out there and say that the atmosphere was a public trust resource, but they recognized that the public trust doctrine can and should be implicated in the context of climate change. Now, there were a couple of courts, including one in New Mexico and one in Texas, that did find that the atmosphere was a public trust resource. And there have been a couple of other courts that have assumed that to be the case without deciding that issue explicitly. So the law is currently really developing on that front. And, you know, I think we're pleased to see when the courts apply scientific principles to recognize how the natural systems actually work. As you know, you know, one of the common fictions is that surface water is not connected to groundwater. And, you know, it's frustrating when that legal fiction is endorsed by a court. Here in Washington, we're far past that. But I know in other jurisdictions, you deal with that problem. So I think that's something we can surmount.
And we're dealing with that in California.
Are you dealing with that in California?
Yeah, there was just, well, thankfully, there was just a court case that has found that hydrologically connected groundwater is part of the public trust. And so I thank our friends at CATS and the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association for bringing this case. And that is getting appealed. But we're still trying to develop the public trust case law here in California. And I think in comparison to many other states, in particular Hawaii, and it sounds like in Washington too, the California public trust doctrine has not been as well explored. So I'm excited to hopefully someday have EPIC explore this.
yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the early great public trust cases came from California. The Mono Lake decision is really one of the first strong modern public trust cases. And agencies, the agency in California that regulates water, you know, is very familiar with the public trust doctrine and is utilizing that in a number of ways. So I certainly think it's one of the legal resources available to protect our resources, especially in the face of a problem like climate change, which touches every level of society.
Well, that is a wonderful segue to climate change. So if the state owns the public trust, the atmosphere for the benefit of all of us, all of its citizens and all the people in its land. What are you asking the state to do? Are there targets, greenhouse gas targets, that they need to meet in order to preserve our public trust?
Yes, that's what we're doing. So essentially, there's three parts of our litigation. The first is that we're asking the courts to uphold the rights of young people. So we are alleging that young people have not only rights that are protected by the public trust doctrine, but they also have rights protected by either the state or federal constitution. And that can come in a variety of different contexts. It can come in the form of a right to a stable atmosphere. That encompasses also the right to due process and equal protection of the laws. We're also asking that the court declare the rights of young people as a means to guide government policymakers and provide a framework for action on climate change. And finally, and the most important part of these cases is, when we win, is the remedy. We're asking that the court order and manage a remedy that enforces and protects the rights of cleanups. And essentially, that would be a climate recovery plan that mandates emission reductions and carbon sequestration efforts that are based on best available science. And how we define that in our case is, our lead expert in this litigation is Dr. Jim Hansen and his team, who's one of the first scientists to really raise the alarm about climate change when he testified in Congress in the late 80s. But he and his team have done, their work is a little bit unique. They have taken a look at what are the safe levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations so that we should be aiming our reduction efforts towards meeting those limits. And their conclusions is that the safe level of atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations is around 350 parts per million by the end of the century. And as you know, we're already above 400. And I have heard, the last article I saw was that they are anticipating that we may reach 410 parts per million sometime this year, which is quite concerning. And what that does is that puts that increase that's associated with temperature rise, and that causes an unstable climate system. And so we have a very short window of time in which we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, lower the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations, and restore the balance of our planet and our climate system. So, you know, the most urgent thing that we're facing, there's several different crises that we're facing associated with this, but one of the most significant and urgent is sea level rise. Because once you get certain temperature increases and we lose the ice sheets, that changes the whole ballgame. Our planet becomes a very, very different place. Not only do we lose large areas of land because of that, but that really changes the climate system in a way that makes it very, very difficult to get back to the kind of climate that humans have evolved to live with. So, you know, the urgency of this is like no other crisis that we're facing. And that's frankly why the youth have turned to the court, because the legislative and executive bodies are not able to respond effectively and fast enough to address this crisis.
Well, you are listening to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, and I'm speaking with Andrea Rogers of Our Children's Trust. Andrea, this is all so fascinating, and I'd like to just focus a little bit more on some of the cases you're currently bringing and some of the youth behind these cases. Can you tell me about some of your clients and what is really fueling their drive and motivation to bring a lawsuit?
Yeah, well, they're the best part of this work. You know, I think if any of your listeners out there ever get discouraged about what our country is facing with Trump and the environmental problems we're facing, if you spend time with young people who are activists on these issues, you really are emboldened and have hope for the future. So my clients include Aji Piper and Adonis Piper, Gabe Mandel, Ren Wagenbach, and Laura and Athena Fain, and Jamie Margolin. And they are a group of kids. You know, they keep on getting older on me, and they're going to start telling me I can't call them kids. Now they're age 12 to 16, and they're very, very committed to this issue and to preserving their rights. They understand what is at stake when it comes to climate change. They understand what the science says their future will be like when you're looking at temperature rise. And they do not believe it's fair for the adults of this current policy generation to sit idly by while their futures are going to be in jeopardy. So they're very frustrated by the lack of action that they've seen. And, you know, they're quite remarkable in many ways. They testify at legislative hearings. They go to court hearings. They're, you know, writing letters. They're speaking to the media. I mean, they are really the leaders of the climate movement. And they're not quibbling over cap and trade and carbon tax. They're standing firm and arguing for action based on science. So, you know, they're quite remarkable, and hopefully you can, some of your listeners can see them speak or have the opportunity to see them speak, because it is quite remarkable. And those are my kids in the Washington case. And then there's another group of 21 youth. Aji, who's my client in the Washington case, is also a plaintiff in the federal case. And the federal case is against the federal government, so now the Trump administration and a number of his agencies. And that case is alleging that the federal government has violated their constitutional and public trust rights. And again, that group of young people is quite remarkable in terms of what they do and the amount of time, frankly, that they spend on these issues. You know, they often say, look, I should be able to be playing video games and doing my homework and worrying about who I'm taking to prom. But here I am fighting for my right to life, liberty, and property. So it's a really interesting way to grow up, and I'm very proud of them.
And you should be. So let's just zoom into Washington, because I don't know if we have time to discuss the federal case. But as you said, the wheels of justice move slowly, and your kids are soon to not be kids. Where are you at in the Washington case, and what more needs to be done?
Yeah, our case is probably one of the most procedural, complicated cases that you'll ever hear about. The class in law school where you learn about procedure is called civil procedure. And the issues that we've dealt with in our case would be in an advanced class. It's very unusual how our case developed. But what happened was we ended up filing a petition for rulemaking with our state agency that is in charge of managing and protecting our natural resources, the Department of Ecology. We asked them to use their existing authority to cap and regulate carbon dioxide emissions based on science. They said no. We went to court. And then after an extended period of litigation, we have secured two very good legal decisions where the judge agreed with us on the law that these kids have retained rights under the Washington State Constitution to a healthful and pleasant atmosphere, that they have rights that are protected by the public trust doctrine, and also through statutory law. Under our Washington Clean Air Act, the State Department of Ecology has a responsibility to protect and preserve and maintain air quality for present and future generations. And our judge gave meaning to that. And ultimately, she ordered the Department of Ecology to promulgate a rule capping and regulating carbon dioxide emissions. Now, unfortunately, what Ecology did in response to that court order was they developed a cap-and-trade program, which, as you know, in California, you guys are talking about that a lot, right, with your cap-and-trade program and what's going to happen with that. But our cap-and-trade program here in Washington, it requires very minimal emission reductions and allows large emitters of greenhouse gas emitters to continue to pollute for years to come. So it certainly did not protect the rights of young people as we envisioned as we started out our case. And because of that, the judge granted us leave to amend our complaint to include two new causes of action. One, that the government's failure to protect the rights of young people violate the public trust doctrine. And two, that it violates the Washington State Constitution as well. So we are proceeding with that case. We have filed that complaint, but it's in a holding pattern until we hear back from the Washington Court of Appeals, because Ecology has appealed the order directing them to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. So once we get the go-ahead, we will prosecute that case and hopefully get a trial within the next year or two. So that's where we are in Washington with some great law, but a lot of other stuff going on. We have in the legislature this year, there's, you know, a couple of different carbon tax proposals. The kids have testified in the legislature on updating our greenhouse gas emission limits. So one of the positive things of this litigation is it often spurs action outside of the courtroom. And that's part of what it's designed to do.
And all of this with a governor that is one of the greatest champions, at least in words, of climate change in Jay Inslee. So yes. I can only imagine how difficult a case like this would be against, you know, let's say Kansas
Mr.
or somebody.
Trump.
Yeah,
or
Mr. Trump. Exactly.
Well,
so,
you know, to be honest with you, I don't know what is worse. I don't know if it's worse to lie to your constituents and say that you're doing everything on climate when the reality is that you're not, or you tell your constituents that climate change is a hoax. I honestly don't know what situation is worse. As far as I'm concerned, you know, climate progress is based on whether emissions are getting reduced in a way that protects the rights of young people. That's not happening in Washington State. It's not happening in the federal government. So frankly, I don't care what the political hyperbole is, you know, the actions, and it's very clear that nothing is being done in a way that protects the rights of young people. So, you know, Inslee's a defendant, Trump's a defendant, and they'll continue to be defendants until they take action to protect the constitutional rights of young people.
All right, so we're just about out of time. Andrea, if folks want to learn more about Our Children's Trust and the variety of cases that your organization has brought, where can we find out information?
Yeah, on our website at ourchildrenstrust.org. It has all of the information about all of our different legal actions, and they have a number of short films of many of our youth plaintiffs as well. And those are wonderful to watch, and you can get to know them and get engaged in that way as well.
Well, thank you so much. And I'll say goodbye to you now and continue all of your good work. And I look forward to having you on again sometime, hopefully in the near future, to learn about all your success.
Thank you so much, Tom. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Tom Wheeler, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was just speaking with Andrea Rogers about her groundbreaking litigation to force government action to address climate change. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the archive programs page at khsu.org. Previous shows are also posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. You can also subscribe to the EcoNews podcast on iTunes for your listening pleasure. You can have it on the go with you. The EcoNews Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks, as always, to Fred for engineering. Join us again next week right here for the EcoNews Report.